From Tribune Tower, WGN Radio presents A Conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything within the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to this week's edition of the Sunday Spin for February 21st. This is our weekly look into the politics of the past week and what lies ahead. So, yes, grab that Sunday paper, that hot cup of coffee, as we've got lots to talk about on this busy political weekend. Well, Dave, what a beautiful couple of days we've had in Chicago.
Can you believe it?
Sure, it was windy as all get out on Friday, but geez, Saturday was absolutely gorgeous. And it just does something to your mood when you feel the warmer temperatures and all that sunshine. And
it really does. It just gives you a good feeling inside that we're moving past the darker days, the colder days,
yes,
and getting closer to some more agreeable weather.
And
for most people, I guess.
Well, and I still have that cold that I picked up in Springfield over a week ago. But I have to tell you, yesterday, like, I felt as good as I've felt in weeks, you know. Just standing outside, visiting the Tree of Knowledge outside Tribune Tower. And,
Yeah, you happen to like that tree.
You know, if only they had Wi-Fi there, I could get a lot of work done.
Give them time. You can get Wi-Fi out there.
Maybe I can sneak it off the coffee shop or something there. But, yeah, just absolutely gorgeous. And, you all know I'm a big Blackhawks fan. And, of course, we got the Stadium Series game against the Wild coming up this afternoon from Minneapolis. But the Sunday Spin team got a chance to go see the Blackhawks on Monday. And they put on quite a show.
We had a great time.
And
a great game, too.
Well, see, I know how to pick these games. I mean, they played the hapless Toronto Maple Leafs, and I knew we're going to get a win. I mean, if you're going to go to a game, you're going to see a win against the Maple Leafs. 7-2.
7-2.
And just what a lot of...
Just came out scoring right away, you know, a couple of goals in the first period and just kept up. Everything right to the end.
Well, and
amazing.
I know it was an especially special game for you.
A first ever to go to a Blackhawks game. And what better way to do it than with someone like yourself who is totally immersed in Blackhawks history, past, present, and looking forward to the future. That was great to be there with you. And man, that crowd is so enthusiastic.
Well, and as I said, we had to be there early because if you've never been to a game, you've got to hear the national anthem.
Got to do the national anthem. We had two national anthems.
Yes, we did.
Monday night.
Yes.
Canada and the U.S. So it was a double bill.
But, the U.S. national anthem at United Center, there's just nothing like it. You get chills. And
you really do.
Even with my cold, you know, that did not stop me from shouting. And like we said, there was a lot to shout about too. With you don't see seven goals in a game very often.
No, and again, it was a wonderful experience. I hope to do it again. And I must tell you, I'm going to drive that Zamboni yet. I saw them, you know,
well,
periodically.
Yes, kind of little lessons there.
I was getting a primer as to how to do it, so I'll get on that ice yet.
Well, and how you?
I can't ice skate to save my life, but I think I can.
Well, actually,
think I can,
you know,
drive a Zamboni.
We should try the rink over at Millennium Park. You and I. Just what do you think?
Are you going to close it off first?
Well, I'll make sure, like, you're wearing, like, bumper pads or something.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. To protect me.
Yes.
Not everybody else, but me.
You'll be fine. You'll be fine.
You've never seen me ice skate before. And
I don't think anybody has seen you ice skate before.
No, not around,
right?
Here. I think it's been something like 40 years since I've been on a pair of skates. But it was never pretty. I can guarantee you it won't be now.
Well, I'll get you a hockey stick that you can kind of use as a crutch.
Okay, fair enough.
To lean on.
Fair enough.
I mean, Well, and Dave, I was thinking of you Friday night. I had just finished writing about the final scheduled Democratic U.S. Senate debate that ABC7 hosted, put the newspaper to bed, and stopped in at the Billy Goat, and I ran into Gene Honda. And for those of you who don't know, Gene is the stadium announcer for the Blackhawks United Center. He's the stadium announcer at the Cell for the White Sox. And what a great guy. And literally, it turns out that he played goalie too. A lot in common. And we're just telling stories about the old Blackhawks and things like that. And he's just a great guy, great conversationist, great Illini alumnus. And he also told me he's going to be the stadium announcer for the NCAA Final Four tournament.
That's going to be just terrific.
I mean, how cool is that?
And as we said earlier this morning when you and I were talking, it's not far away.
No, it's not. I mean, we're
coming into March very quickly.
And March Madness and all that goes with that. And I have to tell you, I'm not normally a big fan of college basketball just because there's 8 million games, and it seems like the season runs forever.
Yeah, but if your team is in it, though, you automatically, I know when Ball State is in it, I'm always enthused.
Yeah, but what I really like, though, is the tournament time because then it's one and done. You got to win or it's over. And just, those first 2 days of the tournament with all of the, the upsets that happen and things like that, I could just be glued to the TV all day watching that. It's just so much fun. But, yeah, it was great. It was great meeting Gene Honda. And, let's get this week going. We've got all kinds of politics going on. We've got we just had the South Carolina Republican primary and Donald Trump's victory there. And we've got Nevada caucus, Democratic caucus, which Hillary Clinton won. And then we've got the Nevada Republican caucus coming up on Tuesday. But Dave's here to keep us up to date on the news. Producer Jasmine is fielding your phone calls. And you can reach us at 312-981-7200. That's also our text line, 312-981-7200. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin. We're also on Twitter at @SundaySpin. Engineer Bob is twisting the dials to make my cold sound less oppressive. And remember, you can find all of our shows on WGNRadio.com. And you can also get our podcast, too, at iTunes by searching for my name, Rick Pearson. Well, coming up, we've got a great show today. After the 7:30 news, my Tribune colleague Kim Geiger joins the show. And Kim was in Springfield last week for Governor Rauner's budget address. And we'll be talking about the budget primarily this morning. After the 8 o'clock news, Dave Treader, president of the Federation of Independent Illinois Colleges and Universities, he'll be joining the show. Dave's also a leader in this new coalition, the Illinois Coalition to Invest in Higher Education. And, of course, Illinois higher education has really been hit hard by the lack of a state budget. And then after the 8:30 news update from Dave, my friend David Merriman joins the show. David is an economics professor and budget expert and a member of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. That's all coming up. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to The Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase Studio in Tribune Tower on Michigan Avenue. It's time for our weekly spin through national politics. And, of course, a big win for Donald Trump, a disappointment for Ted Cruz. The South Carolina GOP primary results are in, and Trump won big, getting 32.5% of the vote. Florida Senator Marco Rubio edged out Cruz for second place, 22.5% to 22.3%. Doesn't get much closer than that. Jeb Bush, John Kasich, Ben Carson each got more than 7% of the vote. But the results, of course, were enough to send Jeb Bush packing. And now the establishment looks like it's moving to Marco Rubio to try to stop Trump. The Huffington Post is reporting this morning that Mitt Romney is planning to endorse Rubio. And that endorsement could come before Tuesday's Nevada Republican caucus. Meanwhile, in Nevada's Democratic caucus yesterday, Hillary Clinton scored a big win, 52.7% to Bernie Sanders' 47.2%. And that could severely slow Sanders' momentum heading into next Saturday's South Carolina Democratic primary. But you've got these votes all coming after perhaps one of the strangest weeks ever in national politics. You had Pope Francis returning from a state visit to Mexico, telling reporters on his plane to Italy that the rhetoric of Donald Trump building a wall was not Christian. That, of course, prompted Trump to start a war with the Pope.
If and when the Vatican is attacked by ISIS, which, as everyone knows, is ISIS's ultimate trophy, I can promise you that the Pope would have only wished and prayed that Donald Trump would have been president. Because it's true. It's true. Because this would not have happened. ISIS would have been eradicated, unlike what is happening now, with our all-talk, no-action politicians. That's what's happening now. The Pope is being told that Donald Trump is not a nice person, okay? Donald Trump is a very nice person, and I am a very nice person. And I'm a very good Christian, because the Pope said something to the effect that maybe Donald Trump isn't Christian, okay? And he's questioning my faith. I was very surprised to see it, but I am a Christian, and I'm proud of it. Okay, for a religious leader to question a person's faith is disgraceful. I'm proud to be a Christian, and as president, I will not allow Christianity to be consistently attacked and weakened, unlike what is happening now with our current president.
I don't know if you have to say you're a nice person to make that a pronouncement. I don't know what that says. But later, the Vatican said that Pope Francis wasn't speaking specifically about Donald Trump, a papal walkback, if you will. And Trump, speaking at a town hall meeting with Anderson Cooper on CNN, also seemed to tone things down.
I think it was probably a little bit nicer statement than was reported by you folks in the media, because after I read it, it was a little bit softer. But the bottom line is we've got to have a border. We've got to have security. We have tremendous illegal immigration in the country.
Well, I'll just say the Pope did go on to say this is not the gospel. As far as what you have said about whether I would advise to vote or not to vote, I'm not going to get involved in that. I say only that this man is not Christian. If he has said things like that, we must see if he said things in that way, and I will give him the benefit of the doubt.
And he also talked about having a wall is not Christian, and he's got an awfully big wall at the Vatican.
Well, the campaigning was going full force last week, but there was a touching moment in South Carolina when a Georgia college student talked about the personal pain in his life at a town hall, and he searched for his faith in God and a presidential candidate when he asked Ohio Republican Governor John Kasich for a hug.
I've heard about the pain of people all across this country. And what I've learned is we're going too fast in our lives. We need to slow down, because there are not enough people who are helping those who have no one celebrate their victories. And we don't have enough people that sit down and cry with that young man. Don't you see that's what it's about? We can rebuild the country, sir, and we can get people on their feet, and we can grow. But is there any substitute for what you just heard? There isn't. So as Americans, let's just renew our spirit. Let's care about one another and not be disconnected. And together we will rise this country from a position of where we doubt to a position again, being Americans, when we are so confident of the future for ourselves and for our children. And this is a hard one. I have two 16-year-olds for my grandchildren someday. Thank you all very much.
That was Ohio Governor John Kasich. The hard-charging campaigning also continued with Texas Senator Ted Cruz using an ad featuring the similar words of Barack Obama and his rival, Florida Senator Marco Rubio, to attack Rubio on immigration.
I'm Ted Cruz, and I approve this message.
When Marco Rubio ran for Senate, he promised,
I will never support, never have, and never will support any effort to grant blanket legalization amnesty to folks who have entered or stayed in this country illegally.
Then Rubio got to Washington and wrote the bill giving amnesty to illegals, using Obama's talking points to make his sales pitch.
We know we have to deal with the 11 million people that are here illegally.
We have to deal with the 11 million individuals who are here illegally.
The bill that Senator Rubio put forward, I think, is a great
place to start.
You are giving legal status to people who have broken the law.
They still have to qualify for it, meaning
passing a background check,
pass the background check,
paying a penalty,
pay a fine,
paying taxes.
Start paying taxes.
It won't be a quick process.
That is a long path.
But it will be a fair process.
But I do think it's fair.
Marco Rubio burned us once. He shouldn't get the chance to sell us out again.
Of course, Rubio, as I said, finishing second place in South Carolina, just ahead of Ted Cruz. Over on the Democratic side, Hillary Clinton continued to work to court African-American voters in South Carolina, as she still faces a determined challenge from Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. To help sell herself, she's got a new ad out featuring the narration of Morgan Freeman.
Her church taught her to do all the good you can for all the people you can for as long as you can. After law school, she could have joined a high-priced law firm. But instead, she worked to reform juvenile justice in South Carolina, exposed racism in Alabama schools, registered Latino voters in Texas, and provided legal aid to families in Arkansas. Her life's work has been about breaking barriers, and so would her presidency, which is why for every American who's not being paid what they're worth, who's held back by student debt or a system tilted against them, and there are far too many of you, she understands that our country can't reach its potential unless we all do. Together, a stronger country.
That's Morgan Freeman narrating Hillary Clinton's latest ad. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Up ahead on The Sunday Spin, my Tribune colleague from the Tribune's political team, Kim Geiger, joins us, and we'll talk about last week's budget message from Governor Rauner.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase studio. While my Blackhawks got to go to the White House to honor their Stanley Cup victory last week, the third time they've gone with Chicagoan Barack Obama as president, something that Obama quickly noted after a 50-year Cup drought. Team owner Rocky Wirtz had a gift for the president that was more than just your usual presidential hawk sweater. It was, as we all know, it's all about the parking.
We also want you to know is maybe you're spending, as you said, a little more time away from the White House in years to come. And so while you're driving yourself around Chicago, we thought that we might want to present you with something that is near and dear to our heart, and that's a parking pass for the United Center. It's not only good for Blackhawk games, but for any event, the United Center, for you and your family. So on behalf of the organization, thank you very, very much.
Thank you. Can I just say, this is the best gift I've ever gotten at the White House. This is really cool. You'd pay for this, wouldn't you? Absolutely. Quigley, I might sell this on eBay.
That was the president, and it was the parking pass actually has the presidential seal on it, too. So, the best gift you could ever get. And if you're a sports fan at the United Center, it's all about the parking. Well, joining me now here in the Allstate Showcase studio is my Tribune colleague from our political team, Kim Geiger. And Kim was in Springfield last week as Governor Bruce Rauner delivered his budget address. And the first thing that struck me is that after, one, presenting a budget while we still don't have a budget, and two, is that after railing against Democrats and basically vetoing the budget that they sent him last year because it was $4 billion out of whack, he came up with a budget plan that's $3.5 billion out of whack, or as much as $5 billion.
Right, yeah. So basically what the governor did this time around was he said, hey, Democrats, I don't want to work with you to pass a tax increase to close this budget hole unless you agree to pass my turnaround legislative agenda. So what I'm going to do is tell you we could spend 32 $32.8 billion, or we could spend $36.3 billion, and there's a $3.5 billion hole there, and you decide if you want to work with me on making the cuts.
But we're basically still, I mean, we're back to, this is Groundhog Day again, right?
Yeah, it's pretty much the exact same situation that we were in last year. The difference is that last year what he did was he actually put out a budget document that spelled out how he would make the cuts. The problem is that the governor can't just make those cuts on his own. He needs the legislature to pass legislation that does it. And because of this other fight that's going on at the Capitol, what happened was Democrats just passed their own legislation that didn't make the cuts that he wanted, and then he turned around and vetoed it. And here we are 8 months later without a budget.
And so he presents two choices. He says, we can go the higher level, but I need my turnaround agenda. And, of course, that turnaround agenda, and he says he doesn't need everything all at once.
Right. He's now saying that. And he also said, you know, it doesn't have to be exactly what it looks like right now. But he didn't say what he was willing to budge on or.
Right. And as we have seen in various legislative proposals that he has presented, they still come down to these kind of union weakening positions, pro-business union weakening positions that Democrats aren't going to move on.
Right. He wants to freeze property taxes, but he wants to do that while also limiting collective bargaining rights for unions that bargain with the public. He wants to create set term limits. He wants redistricting reform. He wants tort reform. He wants workers' comp changes. These are all things that kind of go at the heart of the Democratic power base, so they're difficult to pass just on their own. And then on top of that, it's now linked to the budget. We're already 8 months in without a budget, and things are kind of chugging along.
By court order.
Yeah.
And primarily by court order.
Right.
So there's that choice of go with what I've laid out in my turnaround agenda, or give me unprecedented authority, and I'll make the cuts.
Right.
Which he doesn't want to do.
No.
I mean, he does not want to wear the jacket for these cuts. And so, and the way that this legislation was presented, which would circumvent all kinds of laws, it, quite frankly, wouldn't require the statutory payment to the state pension systems, with the pensions being one of the drivers of state spending and why we're in this kind of budget mess.
Right, right. It would allow him to skip pension payments if he wanted to. It would also allow him to do things like not pay members of the legislature whose salaries are currently going out the door automatically because they're written into state law. So there's just a lot of things in there that the Democratic majority is unlikely to be like, oh, yeah, here, you can have the authority to do this. Go ahead.
And frankly, that's what Democrats in some respects tried a year ago in sending that unbalanced budget, was let him use his authority for what's called a line item or reduction veto, which allows him to, you know, take down amounts in the budget or zero out items in the budget. Mm-hmm. And of course, Democrats are arguing, you want this unprecedented law that would circumvent all these other laws when you have the power of the veto to reduce lines. You can do that already.
Right. But his administration is arguing that when he got that budget, really, because of the existing, because there are so many existing laws and court orders that are requiring money to go out the door, that really his options for what he could veto were limited to K-12 education, which he has said he's not willing to cut spending on that, and then human services, which leading up to when he vetoed that budget, there was a lot, there were months and months and months of a lot of frustration and concern about human services spending already. So he would have been in the position of having to like take billions and billions of dollars out of an already precarious financial situation for human services.
Well, and you know, already and looking at their budget book and looking ahead too, and you have the effects of Obamacare, 2017, I think the budget year ahead, it marks the first kind of phased reduction of federal support for Obamacare.
Yeah.
We go from 100% support to 95%.
Yeah. Medicaid expenses are going up for the state going forward. Yeah. And he had proposed in his first budget, he had proposed cutting Medicaid spending. But that he needs the legislature to go along with that, and they didn't. And so in this one, when he's asking for these broad authorities, one of the things he's asking for is essentially the ability to cut Medicaid spending on his own.
And cut rates, reimbursement rates to hospitals and care providers as well.
Which is not a popular thing to do.
No. We've got a call from John. John, welcome to the Sunday Spin.
Good morning to you. Question I have is, Governor Rauner in a position basically to put out what I would call a poison pill? He has had to make certain state-mandated payments. Can he basically tell the legislature, if you do not get a budget done by June 30th, state funding of education will not happen? Well, I will fund what has to be mandated by, like, for prisons, hospitals, state police, the pensions, but is this one of those items that the court cannot make them do it? And basically tell them, either you get a budget done or nobody's going to be going to school next year, and you guys explain that to the people of Illinois.
All right, John, thank you for your question. And we know from last budget, the only part of the budget that he approved was the K-12 portion of the budget.
Yeah, so he has the ability to say, I won't sign that portion of the budget, although it's unlikely that he's going to get a clean, bill for that this year.
And that's what he's asked for this time.
Yeah.
Just a clean education budget bill.
Right, so it's unlikely that he's going to get that. And he could go ahead and veto it if he wanted. The thing is that this governor has said that that's something that he's not going to do. So that's not really a leverage point for him unless he were to do a complete 180 and completely change his entire sort of philosophy.
And quite frankly, by him saying that he wanted a clean education budget, what he's likely to get is the entire state budget in that education bill.
Yeah, yes. It's very, very unlikely that he's going to get that. But yeah, that's not a leverage point that I think that he would use. And last year, human services spending was one of those potential leverage points. And even then, he kind of showed that he wasn't really actually interested in following through on like deep cuts to human services. That's the kind of stuff where people get really upset and a lot of people get hurt, and it's hard to actually put that into place.
We're speaking with my Tribune colleague Kim Geiger. She's here with me in the Allstate Showcase studio. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase studio with Kim Geiger, a member of the political team at the Chicago Tribune. And Kim was in Springfield last week for Governor Rauner's second budget address, a budget address despite the fact that we don't have a budget to begin with. We've got a call from George. George, welcome to the Sunday Spin.
Hey, Rich. Thanks for taking my call. I was listening to your program, and what really aggravated me was the fact that, you know, the legislature and the governor and everybody, they're all getting paid for not doing their job. It'd be like me, you know, not going to work and getting paid. Sitting around in Congress and not doing what they're supposed to be doing is not what I consider going to work.
All right, George. Well, a couple of things. One, we should point out the governor says he's not taking his salary.
Yeah.
He's turning back his salary. Two, you have basically by constitution as well as by state law, lawmakers have to get paid.
Right. And the reason for that is so that disputes like this between the two branches of government can't be used to hurt lawmakers financially. Like, you don't really want that to be, you don't want people making decisions that are big decisions for the entire state based off of whether or not they are going to get their paycheck.
Yeah, I mean, Pat Quinn tried that, and the courts ruled that you can't reduce a lawmaker's salary during their term constitutionally.
You can't use it as leverage. Like, hey, if you don't vote this way, then I'm going to cut your pay.
So, George is reflecting the frustration that a lot of people have, again, we're Groundhog Day 366. There is no movement, and you had the Democratic leaders summarily reject what the governor proposed, and indeed, you know, there yes, I looked at the budget book and all that, but when you we talked about this $3.5 billion dollar hole, I mean, it's basically right there in the budget book. Like, well, compromise and we'll fix it.
Right. Yes. It's pretty clearly spelled out. I mean, it's not as spelled out as clearly spelled out as it was last year when the governor was very clear, like, this is what I would cut. This is what I would cut. Now he's just like, hey, this is this big hole. We all know about it. Come to the table and negotiate this with me. But it doesn't look like it's going to happen anytime soon. And part of the function of politics is getting things done, but part of it is also resisting. It depends on where you sit at the negotiating table, but that's a fairly standard thing that happens. It happens here, it happens in Washington, it happens everywhere.
And, of course, here we are in an election year.
Yeah,
so the stakes are even higher. And to me, I would argue that it's exponentially more difficult to try to fix things in this election year. Even if an agreement was reached, trying to get the votes for a tax increase would be extremely difficult.
Who wants to raise taxes in an election year?
And of course, you have Rauner saying, well, Democrats have their veto-proof majority. If they want to raise taxes, they can do it.
But they don't really.
But because of Representative Ken Duncan, who's kind of defected from the Democratic side and is allied with Bruce Rauner, they don't effectively have that 71-vote veto-proof majority in the House. Yeah. And also, politically, an election year, Democrats are not going to be the only ones to vote on a tax.
Yeah,
increase.
I mean, even Senate President John Cullerton, who his supermajority is much stronger than Mike Madigan's, even he has said, like, we're not doing that on our own. In fact, we're not even willing to set whatever the tax rate would be. The governor is going to have to decide how much the tax is going to be, and then, you know, we'll approve it.
Well, and also trying to pin a tax increase on the Republican governor.
Yeah, nobody wants to wear a tax increase right now. And the thing is, the way that things are going, for the most part, you know, you had all these court interventions that came in and allowed money to continue being spent. Those things continue no matter how many budget years we go through. So most of state government, the money's going out. What you're really looking at is colleges and universities and some areas of the human social services.
And as we've seen already a warning from Catholic Charities, we've seen the cutbacks from Lutheran Social Services, the safety net is
starting to kind of fall apart. But the question is the pain like enough for anybody to move? And it doesn't look like it.
We've got a call from Sally. Sally, welcome to the Sunday Spin.
Hi, good morning, everybody. I just wanted to disagree with the last caller when he said the legislature wasn't working or they weren't earning their money. They're working. They're there every day as they're supposed to be. They're just not producing results. I just wanted to throw that in. Also, at what point do you think the American public or the Illinois public will get to when they start a recall, some type of recall effort? And my third question is, can they do a two-year budget and just get everything out of the way 2 years, you know, so we don't have to keep repeating this every year? I mean, is there anything in the Constitution that says you have to have a yearly budget?
All right, Sally, thank you very much. Well, one, if there's a budget agreement, it will be a two-year budget because they're going to have to deal with the backlog of bills.
Right.
From this year, and I forget what number that's estimated to rise up to, probably $8 billion backlog of bills. So, no, there's nothing that prohibits that. And, in fact, in a number of states, that's what they do is do a two-year budget. So, effectively, that's kind of what we would be dealing with. As far as a recall, given there is a provision to allow, a constitutional provision that allows for recall of the governor, however, it requires being signed off on by legislators in both parties. It was basically kind of a recognition, a post-Rod Blagojevich kind of thing that was put in. But effectively, under the recall provision as it's written, it's virtually impossible to recall somebody unless they were to be arrested and convicted the way that Rod Blagojevich is. Although, you know, there's been talk about changing that and expanding recall to have it affect legislators, mayors.
Right.
Obviously, you know, the issue with Mayor Rahm Emanuel, although I have to say I'm not sure that that legislation is going anywhere either.
No, and in terms of what they're required to do budget-wise, the governor is required to give a budget proposal, and the General Assembly is required to send him something. Those things happened.
And they're both supposed to be balanced.
And they're both supposed to be balanced, and neither of them were. So, yeah.
That's
the situation.
And that's why we sit still in this fiscal mess.
Yes.
You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Welcome back to The Sunday Spin. We're speaking with Kim Geiger, a member of the political team, my colleague at the Chicago Tribune. And coming up ahead is Dave Treader, president of the Federation of Independent Illinois Colleges and Universities and a member of the Illinois Coalition to Invest in Higher Education. We'll be talking more about the state budget and its effects on higher education.
This is The Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. Welcome back to The Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. Joining me here is my colleague from the Tribune political team, Kim Geiger, as we go over Governor Rauner's proposed budget, as well as the fact of the lingering effects of still not having a budget for the current budget year, 8 months in. And joining me now on the phone is Dave Treader. Dave is president of the Federation of Independent Illinois Colleges and Universities, and also a leader in the relatively new Illinois Coalition to Invest in Higher Education. Dave, thanks for joining me.
Good morning.
What is the Illinois Coalition to Invest in Higher Education, particularly like right now we're not investing anything in higher education as far as the state goes?
Well, true, and that's why it exists. The coalition is a partnership of public, private, and community colleges and local business leaders, members of labor, faculty members, kind of a cross-section of higher ed that I think we're trying to, if nothing else, continually get the word out that this is a problem that's got to be solved.
I was speaking to a couple of folks from the University of Illinois the other day, and, you know, I think about this time of year, this is when students are, you know, looking at where they're going to go to school, high school students, where they're looking to go to college. And I have to tell you, if I were in those shoes, I'd be looking out of state.
Well, I think that's happening, and you're starting to see two things. Certainly, as it pertains to the MAP grants, that's another piece of this. You're finding students either aren't going to attend at all, or those that can are looking at options out of state.
And, of course, out of state tends to be a more expensive option, but there's the fact of having certainty. And we just had on Friday Governor Rauner following through on his vow to veto a measure that the legislature, Democratic-controlled legislature, passed that would free up $721 million for community colleges and those MAP grants. And I want to play this cut of Governor Rauner talking about MAP grants.
It's a very tragic situation. It's very upsetting to me. It's a failure of the government process that this is occurring. I would encourage the students to stay and see if they can be patient and persistent along with us. But I'd also encourage the students contact the legislature, contact whoever their state representative is, their state senator is, contact the speaker's office, and support either one of the two paths that we laid forward so we can fund our universities and fund our MAP grants. Either encourage the legislature to work with our administration to get some reforms so we can grow more jobs and pay for our budgets, or authorize me to be able to cut and move expenses around, and I'll find the money to help pay for most of what's needed in MAP grants and universities. But one of those two scenarios needs to happen.
So be patient. Be persistent. Be patient. I have to think, for a number of your member schools, patience is wearing thin, let alone students' patience.
Well, certainly. Students have been both patient and persistent, and in fact have been contacting their state legislators on both sides of the aisle to make the point. And I think the governor there just said that this is essentially a government not working or just dysfunctional, and we totally agree. And you know, patient is relative here. We're 8 months into a fiscal year without any state budget, and we're probably about 6.5 months, 7 months further than the state's ever been overall. So certainly these students are running out of options. The institutions, both public and private, I think have carried essentially the commitment, I would argue, about as far as they can. And you're starting to see that now evidenced in dropping enrollment numbers.
What for your member institutions? What's the kind of price value of the not having these MAP grants?
Well, there's a lot of different ways to look at it. Certainly, I mean, remember, MAP grants go to the absolute.
Yeah,
media.
And I was going to say, yeah, let's explain what these MAP grants are.
Sure, they're the neediest students in the state. You're looking at depending on where they go, an average family income of less than $28,000. So available to students at community colleges, public fours, private not-for-profit institutions, a few for-profits. A really good use of government funds wherever that student chooses to go, because it's leveraging what the student brings, what they pay in tuition, loan dollars. There's probably not too many programs in the state that are this efficient, but essentially what it means for a student who, remember where we're at in the process here, we're essentially told you're getting this 8 months ago, and then the rug kind of gets pulled out. It's one important piece of that package, those variables I just mentioned. And if you pull one of those variables out, the numbers just don't add up.
I mean, it becomes a house of cards, basically. But, I mean, certainly when it comes to these schools that have been kind of front-loading these costs, I mean, some schools have, you know, larger endowments or have that wherewithal to be able to do it, but the toll that's got to be taking is got to be immense financially.
Well, I think it is, and I always try to be student-focused. Can you imagine the pressure on the student who's working, taking out loans, attending classes, studying, and this is all over their head for the last 8 months. How am I going to continue on here? And for the institution, this is the business of higher ed. It's not a side business where we can make it up somewhere else. I mean, if these students don't show up, it's a wicked combination that's going on here.
So, I mean, what are you hearing when you talk to legislators?
Well, it depends on what side of the aisle. Certainly, I think some legislators are saying we need to pass this, and you saw that with the bill that went to the governor's desk and was vetoed. And I think the governor and maybe that side of the aisle believes that the money's not there, and we have to come up with a different solution. But I think one thing that's clear, if you look at the last two budgets that are proposed, they're pretty devastating to higher education. So I'll let others choose where they want to point the blame, but clearly higher ed's not a priority. It wasn't even mentioned in the recent budget address last week. So that gives everyone in higher education some grave concern, especially when we've got our elected folks out saying we need to attract businesses and create jobs. And I can guarantee you that's not going to happen if you crater the higher education system here in the state.
Dave, I want to talk more about that the governor's proposed budget, as well as kind of what this whole kind of atmospherics has been for higher education institutions. We're going to take a quick break, though. We're speaking with Dave Trotter, president of the Federation of Independent Illinois Colleges and Universities and a member of the Illinois Coalition to Invest in Higher Education. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. 312-981-7200 is our phone number. I'm Rick Pearson, and this is your Sunday Spin. Joining me here in the Allstate Showcase studio is Kim Geiger from the Tribune's political team. And on the phone is Dave Trotter, president of the Federation of Independent Illinois Colleges and Universities, and also a member of the Illinois Coalition to Invest in Higher Education. We're talking about Governor Rauner's budget message last week. And Dave, you kind of touched on this before we went to break about, I guess, a reflection of the governor's priorities and beliefs when it comes to higher education, and the fact that, at least as I saw it in the budget book, as far as the public universities we're looking at cuts from anywhere from 25% to 30% from the public institutions. But it seems pretty clear, frankly, even from his first budget address, that he thinks higher education's a bloated commodity.
Well, certainly, and he said that a number of times, more so in the first budget address. And I think you have to look at, there's a lot of talk about that within higher education overall, and I think it's an appropriate discussion to have. We ought to be looking at the value of the return on our investment from the state, and I think that's a piece that gets left out a lot as to, you know, the benefit of higher ed. We spend a lot of time talking about what it means to the individual that gets a degree, the additional income they'll make, but I think maybe we haven't done a good enough job of laying out what it means in terms of state competitiveness. Look, one way to look at it is right now we've got about 800,000 students in public, private, community colleges around the state. The institutions they attend employ about 175,000 people all over the state. I mean, I'm downstate here. Look in communities like Jacksonville and Champaign and Carbondale and Quincy, let alone the Loop of Chicago, a huge economic driver. So I think if you pull back a little bit and look at the benefit and then realize college-educated folks, not only do they make more, but they contribute a lot more. And if you want to increase your tax base, frankly, to be pragmatic, you want people to earn more, have better jobs, be less reliant on the social service system, it's kind of a no-brainer. So I think we need to start talking about really the benefit side. And if you're going to have a real analysis, you have to look at the cost and the benefits.
Kim?
Well, I was actually wondering what you were thinking about this proposal from the governor. It's just a proposal, but this idea of putting some money into this more performance-based pot and asking higher education institutions to sort of prove their worth.
Yeah, I think it makes sense. It's not a new idea. It's been around, tried in some other states. I think, frankly, the public universities have embraced that model, and there ought to be competition for resources. So, I think that's part of that discussion that needs to take place. But let me also say that if you're going to have a discussion about efficiency and competitiveness and performance funding, you can't put a zero up on the board and then say, mm-hmm. Let's talk about it. It just doesn't make a lot of sense.
Right. And going forward, how much longer can these institutions continue with this budget situation? Can it go another year for them? What happens?
Well, clearly, I don't think so. You've already heard a couple of my public colleagues or institutions mention that they may not make payroll. I believe Chicago State is coming up on that within the next week or two, Eastern, Western. And I would say for some of my institutions that serve a high degree of low-income students, it's going to be really damaging. And at the very least, think about the kind of student that's coming into higher ed right now. And if you just lop off the lowest income students, higher education is going to serve fundamentally a different market. Remember, the people that need it the most are those from the lower income quartile. So, again, just completely illogical what's going on right now.
Well, and I mean, one of my kind of concerns about this is, as we all heard in the governor's speech, and quite frankly, we hear it from all politicians, but particularly among the governor, the issue of how important education is. And so he wants even more money for elementary and secondary education. But then it's kind of like, okay, after that, you're on your own.
Right, and that's, again, back to if you want a competitive state, it doesn't make much sense. And I think also, I think the governor's been on record and that he wants more money to go into higher education.
Right.
That was one of his campaign issues that he ran on. So you can't, and that's great if we're going to put more into K-12 and create a better system there, all the better. But those students will be facing a brick wall when they turn 18, or we'll just simply drive them out of state.
Well, and you touched on some of the, and what we know about the public universities, the fact that I think Eastern has been laying off about 200 people, and they're going under economies. And I got to figure, you know, those schools like Eastern, Western are ones that are probably in more dire financial straits, Chicago State University as well. But as you said, you know, these are kind of, for a large part, regional institutions. They're part of regional economies. And I know one of the things that's been talked about is, you know, does every school have to offer a certain thing, or should these colleges and universities become more specialized in certain things? And I would kind of argue that having a broad course-based offering is kind of essential because they're located in these regions that, you know, help stimulate the economy.
Well, I think we'd argue that too, but remember, we're talking about the last, let's say, 18 months of higher ed budget here. If you go back about 12 or 13 years, you'll see a gradual decrease in funding. So over that, if you go back to about fiscal year 2002, 2003.
The Blagojevich years.
Right, you'll see a downward slope beginning then, and institutions, to the point of getting lean and not offering courses that aren't taken, were there already. I mean, you're looking at essentially over that time period about $1 billion, with a B, being taken out of higher education. So not real shocking that tuition's gone up, given kind of the exodus of state funding, and then this is the ultimate kind of negative cherry on top of the cake here when you go to zero. So it's pretty hard to argue that Illinois higher education is not efficient, because we've been doing more with less, and in this case, less state funding.
I was going to ask about that, though, because one of the governor's arguments is that there is bloat in the system, and that there are administrative costs that are way too high, and he's wanted to kind of rein those in. Obviously, this kind of a budget impasse is not like the ideal way to go about doing that, but is this situation causing universities to kind of trim some fat? Is it accomplishing that objective at all?
Well, I guess. I mean, if Eastern lays off 200 employees and furloughs the rest of their administrative staff for, you know, 30 days out of a fiscal year, and I think similar things coming at other institutions, yeah, I guess that's one way to trim the fat. I would argue you're kind of past the fat and kind of cutting into the bone at that point. And, you know, so again, just the strategy to have that discussion, if those things exist, seems to me totally counterproductive.
David, and truly what you said about, you know, the Blagojevich years, because I remember Blagojevich came into the Tribune editorial board after making a budget presentation, and I said, what happened to the old formula, which was whenever the state had new revenue, natural revenue growth, it was two-thirds to elementary and secondary education and one-third went to higher education. And he didn't know what I was talking about. And we've seen, you know, that decline continue. Dave Treader, President, Federation of Independent Illinois Colleges and Universities, thank you very much for joining me this morning on the Sunday Spin.
Thank you.
We'll be back with more right after this. Up ahead on the Sunday Spin, we'll be speaking with David Merriman. He's an economics and urban affairs professor and budget expert, as we continue our discussion of Governor Rauner's budget message and what do we have to look forward to in this state.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase studio. Last week featured a appearance by Democratic presidential candidate and former First Lady, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. She was in Bronzeville, part of her effort to shore up support among African-American voters. And I found the speech. She was actually speaking the same time that Bruce Rauner was giving his budget address in Springfield. But I found her speech very much kind of Chicago-centric and Illinois-centric to an extent I didn't expect, especially when she kind of went on the attack against Republican Governor Bruce Rauner.
You have a governor who I heard is giving his budget address today. I mean, this is material for some kind of sitcom. Because he'll be speaking without actually having a budget in place. Your governor has refused to start budget negotiations unless his so-called turnaround agenda gets passed first. Now, his plan would turn Illinois around, all right, all the way back to the time of the robber barons at the end of the 19th century. That's where he wants to take this state.
That's Hillary Clinton on Bruce Rauner, and the governor was asked about Hillary Clinton's critique of him.
Sometimes rhetoric in politics gets a little overheated. I think that's mostly a campaign positioning issue for her. She's been under attack for taking so much money from Wall Street and being, you know, basically in the pocket of Wall Street and big banks. And I think this is her way of trying to push back a little bit on this.
And that's Governor Rauner's response to Hillary Clinton's critique. Well, joining me now on the show is David Merriman. David's an economics professor, urban affairs professor, state budget expert, and he's a member of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. David, thanks for joining me this morning.
Thanks. It's very nice to be here.
So you had a chance to hear the governor's budget address. You got a chance to see the budget proposal. And as I kind of started out the show with Kim Geiger this morning, the thing that struck me is that, you know, for on a political point, he talks about part of the reason we're in this budget mess that we're in is because Democrats last year sent him a budget that was unbalanced by $4 billion, more spending than revenues, and that he had no choice but to veto it. But then when he gives his budget address, he turns around and unveils a budget that has a $3.5 billion hole in it.
Yeah. That's well, you know, no one wants to admit the situation we're in, I think, on either side of the aisle, that, you know, we're in a situation where we need more revenue and we need to restrain spending and probably make some cuts. And it's going to take a while. And that's just not a good message, a tough message to give to voters. And so I think the two parties are going to have to come together and make that message, because neither side is going to do it alone. And right now, no one's been willing to take that first step.
And as I argue, that the problem is, to me, even more difficult exponentially because of the fact that we're in an election year.
Absolutely. Legislature is not known for courage in when they're facing votes. The difficult votes they tend to take right after an election, or even more so when there's lame ducks. And these are true lame ducks that are still in office but have already announced that they're leaving office. That seems to be when we get the tough votes.
Then they're able to become more free agents. They count on, well, also lawmakers also count on short memories. And when they passed the temporary tax increase, that was done, I think, in a January vote.
Right, exactly. And a lot of the people who voted for the tax increase were leaving office anyway. So they'd never have any electoral repercussions of that. And it's kind of sad that the legislators don't take on the task of educating the voters about what the situation is. And I think that's really what leadership is about, is we need more legislators that are willing to go to their voters and say, look, we have bad news for you, but given the situation we're in, this is kind of the best we can do. And I think it's incumbent upon the voters to be able to listen to that and hear that and not listen to others who might say, no, all we have to do is cut waste, fraud, and abuse. And, you know, that's the solution that is an easy one to go. We'll make these changes without any sacrifice on your part. And, you know, looking at the numbers, it's very hard to see how that could be done. I think it's going to take some sacrifices to get back to kind of fiscal stability.
Well, and I always love that waste, fraud, and abuse because it's like it's a line item in the budget somewhere, so it's so easy to just, you know, eliminate it.
Right.
Well, right. The thing about this, the $3.5 billion hole, the offering basically that Rauner is making is that, you know, work together, get my turnaround agenda, or give me this unprecedented budget authority to go ahead and shift money around and make cuts. I see that issue of the unprecedented budget authority as that was a non-starter and nobody was ever going to go along with that.
Right. It's pretty clear it's the Democrats are not going to give that kind of authority to the governor. I should say that, you know, the numbers that we my team at UIC put together numbers from the comptroller's office, and based on our calculations, we see a hole which looks more like $6 billion. Governor Rauner has proposed some cuts. It's not clear in the new budget. He's proposed some cuts. It's not clear that he could even make those cuts to get it down to the $3.5 billion. That he's talking about, so that might even be optimistic, I guess, is what we think. So
when you say that he couldn't make those cuts, is that because it's the federal mandated programming or those kinds of things?
Right. You know, some of them would require they violate current union contracts, as I understand it. Some of the pension cuts, the biggest item of the cuts that he proposes is changes in the pension system, which we see essentially, it appears that those cuts would essentially just slow down the rate at which the contributions were made into the pension system, and hence they wouldn't be real cuts, but the state would have to pay that money later.
But I mean, part of what's driving spending in the state is the pensions. So, I mean, and part of the reason we got into this mess was not having paid the required pension contribution.
Exactly right. And so, you know, the huge pension liabilities that exist now are going to have to be taken care of. And it's a legitimate discussion to say, how should we structure those payments? But slowing down those payments is not a cut. It's not cutting spending. It's just restructuring the payments. And we may want to restructure the payments, but we should be upfront about that.
And people have talked about, you know, should we adopt a new payment schedule, that kind of thing, because of what we're looking at, almost a quarter of general revenues now going into public employee pensions.
Right.
But you know, people talk about, well, you know, we raised taxes. We didn't really. When we raised taxes, it was to pay overdue bills, and truly the bulk of it. And while the bill paying did the overdue bills amount came down, the bulk of that tax revenue was basically used to pay the pension debt.
Right. So I mean, I think the. One of the failures of the public discussion is that we talk about it as if, well, we can solve the budget this year and then everything will be fine, when in fact it's going to be a process that takes a number of years, and we have to commit to that process. And I think it's not spending cuts or tax increases. It's both spending cuts, or certainly at least spending, significant spending restraint, and tax increases. We're going to need both of those to get out of this, and it's going to take a while. But I truly believe if we think we want to make the state's economy more healthy, a resolution that said, okay, we've got to do this for a number of years. We're committing to a path to get ourselves in a situation of fiscal stability, of being on a balanced path, I think that would do a lot for the economy. If people had confidence that the state was going to right the fiscal ship, I think that businesses would be more willing to invest, college students that are graduating would be more willing to stay in the state, et cetera. But I think the real issue is very much about committing to a path and the government showing credibility that it's going to fix the problem.
We're speaking with David Merriman from the Institute of Government and Public Affairs with the University of Illinois. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. 312-981-7200 is our phone number. I'm Rick Pearson, and this is your Sunday Spin. And I'm speaking with David Merriman from the Institute of Government and Public Affairs with the University of Illinois, as we've devoted today to kind of the Groundhog Day of Illinois' lack of a state budget. David, how you kind of touched on this a little bit, but how much of is Illinois' economy being hurt because of what the situation has brought over these past 8 months?
Well, I think that's difficult to, you know, put a precise number on or to answer in a scientific way. The Illinois economy has performed over the past 8 years or so less well than we would expect based on kind of traditional the traditional relationship to its Midwest neighbors and the U.S. economy. And I think, you know, there could be various explanations for that, but I think the budget and the political dysfunction is probably related to that. I mean, the direct impacts largely hurt, you know, vulnerable populations. What's getting cut, with the exception, I would say higher ed is one thing, and also healthcare providers not getting reimbursed. That's a kind of direct effect. But most of the other direct effects are for social service or human service organizations where we're seeing layoffs. But I think it's much more about kind of perceptions of the economy than really the direct effect of the cutbacks in government spending that are hurting us.
Perceptions of the economy that we're not doing as well.
We're not a functional state. What businesses really hate uncertainty. There's a great deal of uncertainty about what the tax structure of the state is going to be in the future. I think anyone looking at it carefully would say we're going to see tax increases, but we don't know exactly what the tax increases are going to be. We're going to see reductions in service. We don't know what that will be. Will the state be able to maintain its infrastructure? The state's done a terrible job of maintaining its infrastructure over the past 10 years or so. And all of those things are concerned to businesses that are thinking about expanding. And then I think there's also concern, I think, about young people who are saying, you know, should I settle in Illinois or should I go somewhere else? I don't want to be settled in a state where, you know, there's constant fighting over school funding, where there's not funding for college, for higher ed, where the vulnerable populations are really not being served. Just no one likes to see that. So I think those are the kinds of things that are most hurting the economy.
We've got a call from Matt. Matt, welcome to the Sunday Spin.
Thank you. I'm just wondering why Madigan and Cullerton just don't pass a budget and send it to Rauner. Why do they have to negotiate now with Rauner? Why don't you just put forth what their budget's going to be?
All right. Well, they tried that a year ago, and the governor vetoed it.
I think the thing is that anyone knows that looks at the numbers carefully will see that you need a tax increase, a significant tax increase, as well as restraint on spending. The Democrats don't want to be the ones that are saying, okay, we're going to unilaterally increase taxes and take the blame for that. So they're not going to do it without any Republican vote. So I think that's what's holding up the passing the budget, because they'd have to pass one that was really out of balance, as they did last year.
Well, and we heard Senator John Cullerton, the Senate president, say that basically that if there's going to be a tax increase, it's going to be the governor's tax increase, and the governor will set the rate, and the governor, very clearly trying to put any, even in advance, any political blame on the governor. For the partisan reasons of particularly, you know, as I said, in an election year where you've got things that are just going to be exponentially more difficult. But I do tend to think this is not something that's going to get solved overnight. And in fact, whatever, if there is any kind of resolution, will in fact have to be kind of a 2-year resolution just to kind of figure out how we're going to get out of the stack of unpaid bills that we're rapidly approaching a high point at, somewhere about $8 billion. It's going to have to be a 2-year budget, but more than that, if you do have a dedicated approach, that actually might even help fix the credit rating too.
Right, I think that's also true, that the credit rating agencies would be very happy to see some feasible plan that the state is credibly committed to. That would help a lot. And the one thing about the credit rating, it's not just the state credit rating, but it's local government's credit rating, university's credit rating. All of the other governmental bodies are suffering from the state's failure to get its act together.
And, of course, that because of the when you have a bad credit rating, that means it costs more in interest money. And as the Chicago Public Schools found out with their 8.5% interest rate on their last bond sale. Well, we've been speaking with David Merriman from the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. David, thanks for joining me this morning.
Thanks very much. It's been a pleasure to be here.
You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Well, that's all we have time for on this week's edition of The Sunday Spin. I want to thank my guests, Kim Geiger, Dave Treader, and David Merriman. And most of all, I want to thank you all for listening. And sorry there isn't more happier news on the state budget front, but it's a cold reality. But, hey, it's time for Dean Richards to brighten everybody up.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, state budget. Now you pick it up. Now you brighten things up a little bit. I don't know if we're going to that much because we're going to talk about last night's primaries a little bit. Got a couple of pundits who are going to stop by and talk about that. We are also going to talk with the young man, the young actor who plays Jesse Owens in the new movie Race.
What did you think? Because I love the trailer and I like the concept.
Yeah, I think it's a pretty good movie. I mean, it's a pretty good biopic. I love the Jesse Owens story. I wish they had spent a little more time. I wish they'd spent any time in this movie talking about his Chicago years.
Right.
But it's really focused on those 3 years, 1933 to 36, when he humiliated Hitler
right
to his face at the 1936 Berlin Olympics. So we'll talk more about that coming up.
Great.